Hi, I'm Rachel Sosin, and this is 6 Degrees of Innovation, a podcast that grew out of my natural curiosity and love of innovative solutions to big and little challenges. Each episode, I'll speak with someone who is making an impact in an innovative way. Listen in as we talk about what got them started, what problem they're tackling, and how it's going. This week, I'm talking to Simon Goff. Simon was one of my main tutors during my master's degree, and I can't say enough good things about him. Simon taught me about speculative design and futures thinking. In addition to being a fantastic teacher, Simon is a service designer who facilitates design as culture at organizations, particularly helping to embed design and strategy and across industries and disciplines. Hi, Simon. Thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate it.
Hi, Rachel. Yeah, thanks for asking me along. So yeah, it'd be nice to chat.
Wonderful. Thinking back to our time around the table in a classroom, there were so many different things that we covered, and I learned so much from you about all sorts of different ideas within the overall realm of innovation. So I sent you a fairly long list of a ton of different things that all struck me as really interesting. Everything from hyperlocal economy and community to unschooling and conscious capitalism and kind of capitalism and innovation and where there may be some challenges and then just design at large. So what do you think makes sense to talk about?
I think for me, what was interesting about the list that you sent was the kind of, as much as it seemed like a kind of diverse range of topics, I think there was a definite thread that ran through for me. You're talking about the idea of hyperlocal, talking about the ideas of things like unschooling, which maybe we might want to explain a little bit more as well. About this, and then capitalism, in general. And for me, there was this definite idea of the kind of small scale, the kind of human connections, the local, and the sort of the large scale, the kind of the global, the kind of institutionalized, I suppose, for me. So maybe it's about, that's an area that we could talk about a little bit more. The idea of how those two things maybe sit together or how they kind of oppose each other, what the implications are. So maybe a good starting point, I suppose, is to talk a little bit about unschooling, because maybe that's something people are not familiar with. So for me, one of the things that's kind of an inspiration is a whole kind of load of work that came out, I suppose, in the 1970s, when a lot of stuff seems to have kind of got published that was particularly interesting and relevant now still. So there's a kind of book around the time called Deschooling Society, written by somebody called Ivan Illich, who was a Austrian philosopher. And basically, the whole sort of premise of this work was the idea that the things that we think, even if we think that they're good, like the big institutions that we live with every day, like whether it's education or health or whatever, ultimately, at scale, those things kind of work against us. So they become, as they grow, something that actually makes us dependent on them and doesn't necessarily serve us in the way that perhaps we would want them to, or that we intended when we created them. So the whole idea of the deschooling then became kind of unschooling. And so ultimately, this whole approach became something which was where we tried to think, what's the alternative to, I suppose, institutionalized education? How do we think about other ways that people might learn? And so there was a whole movement around the same time, which was about kind of interest-led learning. How do you support people, children, in particular, to explore their own interests, so how to basically move away from the school model, the idea that you need a sort of a set of things people need to learn, a curriculum, and actually the best things that you can learn are things that you're interested in, which actually is quite, I suppose, controversial, I guess a lot of people who work in education or have grown up in a sort of formal education system find it quite weird. But the reality is that this is what we did with our children. So, you know, one of them went to school for like a year at the beginning, and then neither of them went to school after that. And we didn't do any formal lessons. We didn't do any kind of subjects with them. They basically just did whatever they wanted, pretty much, as much within reason. That's what we did. And I think when you tell people that, they get a little bit like, what, you didn't do maths, or, you know, you didn't do these subjects. But yeah, that's basically how it was. And in fact, they've both just gone to school recently to do their GCSEs because they wanted to. Which is another unschooling approach, that actually, if that's what they want to do, then it's still unschooling in theory, although I guess that's a little bit tricky. That's it. So that thing, and the reason that I kind of pulled that out from the list of what you sent me, is because the focus of this is ultimately, what are the kind of the smaller networks, the human connections between things, the things that are, you know, that bring people together with their interests, that are like the opposite of the institution or the large scale. The kind of process of education. And I think that's a really interesting idea, that actually these pockets of trust, of human connection, of interest-driven kind of exploration and curiosity around the world are actually what makes us better learners, improves our capability to learn, and helps us learn, you know, new things that maybe other people wouldn't have taught us. So, yeah, that was... I just thought it's worth kind of giving an explanation of unschooling as a starting point, because I think it covers a lot of the themes that you're talking about here. Trust between people, which I think is really important. And actually, one of the things that you, and I think, you know, when you talk about some of the things that we learned on the course, on the MDES, one of the things that we talked about was things like speculative design and the future. And I think there's a strong relationship with that, in the sense that we build things now around an idea of what the future will look like. But actually, the future is ultimately shaped by people, by us. And so it's very hard to build even an education system that prepares people for the future when we don't know what the future is. Instead, if we recognize that the future is created by us and what we're interested in, then why not think about that as the basis for the education system that we actually use? I guess that's the part of the approach for me.
I have so two thoughts that are not related, but in response to what you were just saying. First, I think I realized I hadn't thought about this before until you were really talking about unschooling and what it looks like. Is in many ways that's kind of how you taught us. I think you would come in, or at least it was sort of perhaps influenced the way you taught us. You would come in with a goal or a topic or something kind of broad, and then based on our interest and our understanding and whatever, we would kind of navigate around that. So, and I think that was incredibly rewarding for me. So I think that's great. And I also think it's interesting that you're saying, you know, how do we build education for a future when the future is being built by us? And it's this sort of weird loop. I think it's interesting that your degree is in economics, which is all about trying to predict the future based on the past and sort of ignoring that the future is determined by the present. So that sort of makes me chuckle. I'm curious to know, how did your children adapt to going from unschooling to traditional GCSE course? And I think about how the, you know, they're two such very different models. And I think unschooling empowers the individual in a way that traditional education doesn't always do so successfully. Was it a culture shock for them?
Yes. Yeah, it was a culture shock in a kind of a day-to-day sense. Obviously, I think, you know, this idea of having so many people around at the same time is obviously pretty overwhelming. The amount of, obviously, time restrictions and moving from one place to another and all of those things that are kind of structure that are imposed are obviously new in a sense. But I think the thing that's interesting is that they obviously went into that experience with a love of learning and of curiosity and a kind of self-determination as well, which I think really helps, because that allowed them to look at the situation and know what they wanted to get from it. And I think that's kind of important. So that helps a lot that they can do that and that they have done that. But yeah, I think it's that kind of drive to be really kind of self, self-driven, to have your own interests, to know what you want to do in a circumstance. And actually, I think that's one of the things you lose when actually the thing becomes a process, is that you don't have, things are kind of done for you a lot more. Mm-hmm. You have people to tell you where to go, what to do, when. You don't have necessarily the time to reflect on what you want to do and when you want to do it. Some of the founding principles around unschooling sound weird, but there's notions of things like boredom as a tool as really interesting. So for example, we don't allow children to get bored, or we worry when children are bored. If you look at what happens over the summer holidays or any holidays in the UK, there's always a conversation around how do you stop your children being bored? How can you constantly keep them occupied all the time? And actually, boredom is a hugely important thing. It's when we get bored that we start to think about what else can we do? How can we actually do something for ourselves to get us out of this boredom? So I think this ability to sort of do things like this are building parts of our brain that maybe we don't get when we're in a formalized institution like school normally.
Yeah. I think that that idea of leaning into boredom and exploration is so important. And I think it's especially in the US where people are starting to talk about, university preparation when children aren't even reading yet. And that I think that idea of coming back to self-directed learning and experience is important. And I feel like I have, my parents sort of raised me I went to a traditional school, but my parents definitely kind of raised me in a little bit of that, that kind of mode. And I think then as I got older, watching my peers sort of devolve when left to make decisions on their own or left to entertain themselves, and seeing how that can really, like, without those skills for self-sufficiency, it could be really, really challenging. I think that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, talking about the themes of that you sent me in the original sort of email and the connections between those. So I think there's some universal things, isn't there, about how do you create a better environment for people to be self-determining and to kind of find their own way in things. So you mentioned, obviously, with the MDES, with Ravensbourne, and my teaching approach. I mean, it was always a little bit of a kind of weird thing for people that I was talking about unschooling, but I was in a formal institution sort of teaching. But it's interesting, and I'm glad. No, I'm kind of glad that it came across that's not my style to sort of say you've got to know these things by the end of the session. That it is more about this is what we're going to, like you say, this is what we're going to explore, and what I'm interested in is what you're interested in, because I think that's the way that we all learn more is ultimately by kind of exploring that. So yeah, I think that idea of self-determination, of knowing what interests you, of knowing what you want, I think these are important skills. But I also think the reason that the topics that we talked about link up is, for me, that idea of the local, the self-determined, the kind of exploring smaller scale interest is one side of a coin, when the other side of the coin is like big scale, process driven, the idea that there are things we have to get done, there's productivity, there's a goal that we're aiming for. I mean, there's a lot in those topics, but for me, I think that's quite interesting. How much of the world that we live in is very productivity and process driven, as opposed to exploration driven and personal interest driven, and those kind of local smaller connections. I think that's always really fascinating to me, because for as an economist, like I say, economist, having a degree in economics doesn't make me an economist, but that interesting different models that how things work like that has always been really fascinating. And I think you see it through all the threads of those ideas, from big business to small local business to unschooling to large-scale education? You know, what are those differences, and what does it mean if we pursue one rather than the other? I think that's always a really fascinating topic.
Yeah, I think so. One of the first conversations that I remember having with you was about capitalism and innovation, and I remember it was kind of funny because we didn't know each other super well. So like, I think neither one of us kind of knew like just how frankly we could speak with the other. And you said something to the effect of capitalism has killed innovation, in the sense that, you know, particularly for the big institutions, for the Apples and for the Microsofts, and as much as they may speak about innovation, really they're looking for the tweaks to the sure thing. And so I think, I can't remember if this was your example or if this has just sort of been how I have seen it, but I just keep thinking about how the mobile phone has really not changed dramatically in the last 10 to 15 years. And yet, if we look at the iPhone, you know, the iPhone 1 and the iPhone 14 are essentially the same device with some like sort of hardware improvements, and yet we have had 14 iterations. And then in terms of people and individuals, you know, there's this, we can't be bored, so we must get the new iPhone. We can't, you know, we can't explore, so we stick with the same iPhone. And I will be perfectly honest, I have the iPhone, I have the iWatch, I have the i, like, I'm 100% Mac, so definitely the, you know, I recognize my complicity in this. But I think as you talk about how there was a thread through everything I was saying, which is also why you're a fantastic course leader, the difference between sort of unschooling and the empowerment and the self-determination that you get with the kind of lack of exploration in the large scale institution, I think is an interesting tension. And I guess, could you, I don't know quite what my question is, but could you speak a little bit more to that? You're much more coherent and better at this than me.
I think the phone example is really interesting in the sense that, you know, years ago when Apple brought out the first iPhone, it was massively disruptive. You know, this was something without a keyboard. Everything had a keyboard. You know, it was like BlackBerries and whatever at the time. And then it was touch screen, and it kind of had apps. You know, it was really different, I think, than things that had come before. And like you say, over time, it's got to the point where there's very little difference between each model. And I think, you know, that is about what you were saying. It's ultimately when you get to a scale, you don't want to mess too much with the formula. You just want to, you know, you've got to keep the machine going, and you've got to kind of keep people buying new ones, and you've got to maintain the kind of revenue from that. So you it's hard to disrupt when you get to scale. So I think that's a really important aspect. So, you know, when we talk about innovation, this idea of keeping it small scale, of keeping it local, of keeping it loose, of keeping it less kind of processy and operation, you know, big operational, I think automatically kind of gives you an opportunity for innovation in a different way, because you're not afraid of unsettling a big machine of which many people depend on, or which kind of drives and kind of involves a lot of people. You've actually left it at a level where there's an opportunity for innovation to happen. And I think, you know, there's a book which talks about that, which is John Thacker's book around sort of how to thrive in the next economy. There's an overwhelming theme in that book, which is about the small scale, you know, the kind of the little innovations that are going on all over the place. And it's inspiring to look at those small projects, but of course they're not well known, because they're not scaled up, they're not big, they're not visible to everybody, but they're happening all over the place. So I think when we talk about innovation, our minds automatically sometimes go to the idea of what's a big thing that's changing the world, rather than what are lots and lots of small things that are changing the world. And so that's not a new thing. I mean, that's, you know, that's obviously something that a lot of people are familiar with and know about, but actually we still are in the mindset that what is innovative is something really big, you know, something that everybody can see or access that changes things on a big scale. And the challenge for the smaller scale things is how do we connect people with them? How do we connect mm-hmm. people with those ways of thinking and operating so that they can see what these little innovations are and that they can adopt them, learn from them, but ultimately recognize that they're never going to scale. And scale is the enemy of those things. So it's a different way of thinking, isn't it? Ultimately, this kind of smaller scale kind of connection, these kind of little innovations that are going on from the larger scale innovations that we're all familiar with. And I think the problem that we have generally is that we are in a mindset of the big scale. You know, we mm-hmm. kind of grow up with it. We think that, you know, everything from business through to institutions, through to, you know, learning is about how can we scale up? How can we have impact? How can we reach more people? How can we do more things? How can we be more productive? And that kind of, you know, permeates our brains completely so that, you know, if something is small, we don't necessarily give it the same value, even if lots of small things are having more of an impact. So I think those things are an issue of perception for me. Mm-hmm. You know, and so my interest has always been how to sort of support or help those smaller things, whether it's through the way that my children learn or what we do on the course on the MDES, or you know, even my work, I guess, in things like facilitation, which is trying to help make conversations happen, make new things happen, create the context for those things to happen, but not be so concerned on the scaling up, which is, I guess, where I differ from other people. Sometimes working in that space, I'm not really focused on it.
How does that jive when you are, you know, how do you have that conversation with someone who is just focused on, or maybe not even focused on scaling up, but has only ever seen, you know, progress as scale? How do you shift that?
I think I've been heavily influenced myself by people. I mean, I think I probably was, you know, a few years ago of the similar idea that, you know, if you can kind of find something and create something new and innovate something, then what you want to do is think, how can we bring this to everybody? How can we scale this up? But I think over the last few years, different people and different ideas have changed my focus. And I still think, I come up against people and I'm having to think about that all the time. But so, for example, you know, when you look at people who are like facilitators, like open space facilitators, people who do things like on conferences or things that where they're about sort of, you know, smaller scale conversations, they're quite, that whole idea is quite inspiring for me, because you know, there's no focus on outputs or outcomes. Even it's not even about scale. It's like, actually, in this environment, we don't even have to create anything. It's about that we've had new connections, that we've met new people, that we've had interesting conversations, perhaps we develop new knowledge and new ideas, but that's it. There's no pressure to go beyond that. That's always been quite inspiring as somebody who's got a design background and has been focused on making stuff. The idea that we don't have to make stuff is kind of interesting. And then I suppose I was also quite influenced by things like the transition design movement, which I think is probably something that we maybe explored or has been explored on the course anyway, because you know, those ideas that we're talking about, what they call cosmopolitan localism, I think are really interesting. That you know, you can keep things small scale if you can share knowledge globally about how to keep and do innovative things small scale. Then that's the kind of scale in a different way. That's quite interesting. But yeah, those things have changed me. But in terms of having the conversation with other people, I think it's still a challenge when you're doing work for corporations, for example. Mm-hmm. And in the last couple of years, doing work with some quite large corporations, but I suppose my role has been very much in building communities of interest and communities of knowledge that help people to do better work with their immediate people. So I suppose I've not been focused on that scale and you know, money making part. It's still about building mm-hmm. capability through learning and through the ability to do new work in a smaller scale within those organizations. So I guess I found my niche is the way of talking about that. In that I'm avoiding the whole scale. That's not my concern. What I think the strength of an organization is its ability to adapt and be flexible mm-hmm. and to empower people to have agency and to you know, kind of determine their own sort of things that they want to do and to start their own initiatives and to create their own communities. So yeah, that's I guess that's the facilitation part, isn't it, ultimately, is that it's not just about what you do in a workshop environment, but it's how you build these kind of abilities for small scale things to happen within even large organizations. So I guess that's the thread as far as that's concerned.
Which does then connect very nicely to unschooling. And if you can't teach, I guess sort of like there's no age at which you have to learn these things. It's not like, well, you know, I'm too old to learn it now because I've already finished my schooling. You can learn these ideas of adaptability and exploration at any stage in life and kind of in any environment, maybe.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, no, absolutely. I think one of the things I was thinking about earlier when we were talking was that there's a nice little series of videos of Alan Watts, who was a Zen Buddhist philosopher. And he did a series, there's a lot of stuff of his recordings online. But there's actually, and it's going to sound bizarre, there was a couple of his videos or his speeches that were put together to animation by the people that made South Park. And that's going to sound really weird. but actually, they're really beautiful things. And one of his videos is called Music and Life. It's a really interesting video because and a kind of talk, because he's basically talking about this idea that we go through the whole of our lives with an idea that every stage we're doing something because that gets us to the next stage. You know, we have to learn this because if we learn this, then we can do this. And if we have to learn this, then we can do this. And then we have to get this job to get the next job. And then this next job to get the next job. And then you kind of get to the end of all of it and go, where did I get to? Like, ultimately. And so you should, you know, if everybody has a chance to watch that video, it's really interesting and inspiring. But it is a reminder that we get very easily sucked into this idea that we've got to achieve things by certain points. So to your point about education, it's like, yeah, you can learn anything at any point. There's a lot of theory around the fact that people can even learn to read at 12, 13, and it doesn't affect them in any way. You know, it really turns those things on its head, you know, what our expectations are of what we should do. So I think, you know, tying that into the whole theme of this, you know, the small scale versus kind of the large scale and the machine, it's a reminder that those things that we think have to happen aren't necessarily true. And that actually, you know, we are being presented with an order, a way that we have to do things that isn't necessarily right or isn't even necessarily based in scientific fact. So, yeah, maybe those are things that we should re-examine in what we're doing and what we're interested in.
I think that a phrase that sort of stuck in my head a moment ago as you were talking is sort of like, I feel like you're almost a quiet revolutionary. In the sense that like you are, you're bringing all of these really different ways of learning and engaging and kind of functioning into the world through the various, your various avenues, but all in very, kind of achievable ways. So it's, I feel like you're like having this, kind of seismic impact in very subtle changes that feel much more accessible for people. And they may not even realize that they're having, you know, dramatic shifts until much later. And I think that's very cool.
Well, thank you. Thank you for saying that. I mean, I think I wouldn't imagine at all that I'm having that much impact, but I would say that I suppose one of the things that I don't know where it's come from, but one of the things I've always found really interesting is that actually people don't generally realize how much of everything is up for grabs. I think that would be the thing for me that's interesting. So, you know, if you think about the things that you believe, the assumptions that you have, the things that you expect, I think it's quite interesting. Try and really reflect on how much of it is something that is true and how much of it is something that actually is just been made up by other people. Because everything pretty much in the world is just stuff that's been made up by other people who were similarly unsure about what they were doing at the time, right? So I suppose one of the latest, for me, things that's driven my interest is, you know, towards the latter parts of the course that I'm teaching is trying to bring in economic theory for designers, you know, so trying to really engage them with economics and to think about how the world works in that sense, and to almost help them see that as a design material in itself. And there's lots of people doing that kind of stuff now that are inspiring, you know, like Kate Raworth and Mariana Mazzucato and people like that who are bringing economics into more of a design space. But I find that really interesting. I think if one thing has happened through all of these evolutions of design, it's maybe the realization that we can design our world, our life, our education, how the economy works, collectively, not individually, but at least recognizing that it's up for grabs, that we can tinker and change those things.
Yeah. I think that is, I think, one of the scariest things to learn, but also one of the most important things to learn, is the idea that, like, I, or anyone, but sort of speaking in the personal, I only know what I know. And I, there is, you know, perhaps an infinite world of knowledge that I haven't learned yet. And so I can. And then that, you know, from the individual, that also sort of spans out to a, on a broader sense, like we as, you know, a society know that, I don't know, we exist within the universe, within the galaxy, within the universe, et cetera. And yet, you know, a few hundred years ago, we viewed that entire system completely differently. And so in another 200 years, we might view the system entirely differently again. And so knowing that knowledge is sort of is really framed within time is, I think, something that really coalesced for me throughout the course and has really changed the way I then kind of look to how I explore the rest of the world. And I think that's probably in large part thanks to kind of the unschooling elements that you brought to us. I do want to ask you my final question that I ask everyone. And in some ways this connects to what you were saying about in general, people sort of don't know what is up for grabs. I think often people tackle challenges with the skills and knowledge that they have and the ideas that make sense to them. And they're focused on addressing a challenge. And so they don't necessarily think of themselves as innovative, particularly since we often think of the word innovation as, you know, big, large scale. And so I was wondering if there is anyone or any organization that is doing something that you think is innovative and that you're really excited about. And what is it?
You know, for me, I mentioned, these are kind of obvious choices. I think, you know, people like Kate Raworth are really interesting because they are doing stuff which is about challenging how we see the world and economics and that kind of side of stuff. So I pick people like that. I mean, other than that, sorry, I was just thinking about, you know, kind of individuals who are maybe putting some of the things we're talking about into practice. I guess there's people like Imi Kaur at Civic Square in Birmingham. There's people like Tessie Britton as well, who are kind of, you know, looking at very participatory local economies and that kind of stuff. So I think, you know, if you're thinking about people who are, you know, innovating by actually putting into practice these different ways of looking at the economy and localism and all that kind of stuff, then yeah, they would be a couple of people that I should have thought of when you asked me the question straight away.
Well, I mean, I think that just like boredom is really important in getting in helping us navigate, so is silence and thinking. And it's just unfortunately silence and thinking aren't conducive to a podcast.
Exactly. Yeah. That'd be a whole different series of podcasts for sure.
But thank you, Simon. I really appreciate you joining me for this. And thank you both for this conversation, but also just for being an incredible tutor while I was back in school in a great and exciting and like so out of my normal way of functioning life. So I really appreciate it. Thank you.
No, well, thank you, Rachel. Thank you for inviting me and thank you for working with me in your learning journey as well.
Thanks. Special thanks to Simon Goff, my guest today. You can find a link to the Alan Watts video and the books that he mentioned in the show notes. Thank you to you for listening. please be sure to rate, review, subscribe, and maybe one day I'll be the next Sarah Koenig. The podcast theme music is Strangers in the Night by Vocalista, downloaded from upbeat.io.